Whenever we study the Bible, we want to understand how God would have us respond to the Bible. So it's not enough for us to just listen to the Bible. We need to understand how we need to respond to what God said. And in order to do that, what we really need to do is we need to start with the first audience that God spoke to. See, God spoke to certain people. He spoke through certain people who lived at a certain time. He spoke to certain people who thought in a certain way. And so one of the things that we want to do when we study the Bible, when we hear the Bible, is we want to try to do our best, first of all, to think through the way they would have thought about what they heard. And that's why as we begin to look at the book of Genesis, I want to take a second to look at some of the ways that people viewed the world that day, in that day. So it's helpful for us to understand some of the stories out there about how the world came to be. It's helpful to understand what the nations around them would have taught about how their world came to be. One of those stories begins with some ancient water beings that existed, in their view, before the gods. So the gods didn't even exist at this point. And one of this ancient watery dragon named Tiamat decided to produce the first gods. So she produced the first gods, and then she got tired of the gods, and her husband did too. And so they plotted to just kill off these gods that they had created. Well, eventually there's this champion that arises named Marduk, this false god named Marduk, and he goes and slays Tiamat, and in the process, he ends up creating the world. He uses her body to create this, the sky, the clouds, and the sea. Now, for us, obviously it seems crazy that anybody would believe that. But as crazy as it seems, they did really believe this story. They may not have thought of it in the same scientific ways that we might have been programmed to think about things. But they, nonetheless, they believed that this story about Marduk and Tiamat and other stories like it explained how the world came to be the way that it was. It answered their question, how did we get here? And their belief in how the world came to be and how the world worked impacted how they lived. So they believed that there were many gods that were busy, and they were the product of the universe, and they were busy doing different things. Things happened because the gods were doing them, but the gods were not in charge of the universe. There were rules, natural laws that determined even what the gods had to do. And so that was the way that they viewed the world. But if the Israelites believed that worldview, they would not be trusting and knowing the one true God, the way that he truly is. They would not be worshiping and treating God the way that he should be treated. So God is very gracious in pointing out this is not the way things really are and giving them a worldview. Now, you might ask, well, why is that important for me? Well, how we view our world affects how we live. It's important for us to view our world correctly. Listen to how one modern perspective on the world is expressed here, and specifically talking about how misfortune works, especially how it works with God. Harold Kushner is a rabbi, and he wrote a book called When Bad Things Happen to Good People, and he addresses this subject of misfortune. He says, God does not cause our misfortunes. Some are caused by bad luck, and some are caused by bad people, and some are simply an inevitable consequence of our being human and being mortal, living in a world of inflexible natural laws. The painful things that happen to us are not punishments for our misbehavior, nor are they in any ways part of some grand design on God's part, because the tragedy is not God's will. We need not feel hurt or betrayed by God when tragedy strikes. We can turn to him for help in overcoming it precisely because we can tell ourselves that God is as outraged by it as we are. Now, we could even, that's something that we might even come to conclusions as, but in the end, what we're left with in Kirshner's world here is a God who's just doing the best that he can to deal with the painful things that we experienced. You know, he's not in charge, though. He's not in charge of the world as Kushner sees it. And it would appear that Kushner's God is not actually that different than the pagan gods of Israel's day. You know, he's a God who's part of this world with inflexible natural laws. He's bound. He can't do anything about those laws. He's stuck here like us. But that's not what the Bible teaches. And as we look at Genesis 1, it's going to address our worldview. It's going to tell us how we should view the world, how we should view God, and how we should then respond to God. And it's very important for us to do that because it affects how we live our everyday life. So Genesis does not describe a God who is unable to deal with these issues because he's stuck in our imperfect world with inflexible laws. That's not the God of Genesis. He transcends our world because he made our world. So many today look at Genesis chapter 1, which is where we're going to be, and they would say this could not have happened for various reasons. And they say Genesis is really just poetry. Those that are trying to defend Genesis chapter 1, they say Genesis 1 is poetry. And then more conservative scholars, they still try to qualify Genesis 1 and say, well, it's not really quite history. The only problem is that the natural reading of this passage based on Hebrew grammar is to take it the same way that you take the rest of the stories in Genesis, which are intended to be taken as actual history. So the intentions of the writer seems to be to take this as history, and the rest of the writers in the Bible, both in the Old Testament and the New, seem to have believed that this actually happened. So if we're to embrace the worldview of the Bible, we should probably take the same perspective and understand this to have happened. So let's take a look at the very beginning. Let's look at Genesis chapter 1. It's a very easy place to turn to in your Bibles. Very, very beginning. And let's see what happened. Let's see how things came to be the way that they are, how things are now. And then, most importantly, how we should live in light of that truth. So let's look at the first two verses. It says, "In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The earth was without form and void, and darkness was over the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters." Now that first sentence there, some people take that to be a summary, just summarizing what the whole chapter is going to be about. But I think that the grammar kind of tends to tell us that this is actually saying the first thing, that the action that happens before the story picks up in verse 3. So this is giving us an action. In the beginning, at the very beginning of it all, God created the heavens and the earth. Now, the word created there, in and of itself, it doesn't say that God created this out of nothing. But it does imply what people call creation ex nihilo, creation from nothing. It implies that. It doesn't say it specifically, but it implies that. The words, the heavens and the earth, are a way of talking about the whole universe. It's the same way, it's a figure of speech that takes parts of something to talk about the whole. So if we could talk about the human body, and we could say flesh and blood, or flesh and bone. Or we could talk about everybody in the room and say young and old. So in this way, when he says heavens and earth, he's talking about the entire universe. And Moses is very deliberate when he uses the word created in this chapter. It only shows up at certain points. It only shows up when something new is there. So you have to look down. The next appearance is in verse 21, where you have the first animate life, first animals. And then it shows up again in verse 27, where you have the first humans. So the question is, well, what is new in chapter 1 and verse 1? The universe, which implies creation from nothing. He created something brand new, the universe, its existence, and nothing else is around before that. And he says this is in the beginning. So before that, there was nothing. In the beginning, he made the universe. Now, the question we would have then is, what did God create at this point if we have a whole chapter left that talks about creation? And I think that we get a sense of what he's talking about by the next verse. In verse 2, it describes the initial state of the earth. It describes it in four comments. It says that when God first created the earth, it was without form, was void, darkness was over the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. So it's telling us what that first initial creation looked like. One commentator describes this verse this way. He says, "Just as the potter, when he wishes to fashion a beautiful vessel, takes first of all a lump of clay and places it upon his wheel in order to mold it according to his wish, so the Creator first prepared for himself the raw material. with a view to giving it afterwards order and life. So Genesis 1:2 is saying that God had not yet formed the earth into something habitable. It was without form. He had not yet filled it with life. It was void. He had not yet organized or created light. There was darkness over the face of the deep. Those are the three things that are unfinished with this initial creation that he's going to go in with the rest of the chapter and fill out. This is what he's going to address with the rest of the chapter. But the truth of the matter is, if we were to look back at Moses' day, this is quite different from the stories in Moses' day. They believed that the world began in a chaotic mess. Now, there are some scholars that look at this verse and they see a chaotic mess. But the problem is the way that Genesis speaks and the way that these other myths speak, where they talk about chaos, is remarkably different. They're very, very different. In these other stories, you have this water dragon that is churning and attacking the gods, and the gods have to do this great battle against this chaotic force. And that's the striking thing about this text in light of the context. There's no battle. This is actually a very calm description. If this is chaos, the author did a very bad job of describing it as chaos. All we have here is no dragon. There's just water. It's called the deep. There's no raging. It's just dark. The last thing that we read here in this verse is that the Spirit of God is gently hovering over the face of the waters, much like a bird hovers protectively over her nest in Deuteronomy 32:11. Same wording's used there. So this is a gentle kind of description. Now, the doctrine of the Trinity was not understood by people in Moses' day. So when they looked at this, they just understood that God was powerfully overseeing his creation, powerfully watching over it. Now, we who have received progressive revelation, we know that the Spirit of God is the third person of the Trinity. But in either case, this is not chaos that's being described here. This is an unfinished product that the Spirit of God is hovering over, ready to do something. This is basically the divine potter who's created his lump of clay, and he's about to create a masterpiece. That's what we read in these first two verses. Now, the first thing God does is he shines light in the darkness. There's darkness in verse 2. He shines light into that darkness. Look at verses 3 through 5. It says, "And God said, let there be light. And there was light. And God saw the light, that it was good. And God separated the light from the darkness. God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. And there was evening, and there was morning, the first day." So this is the first day of creation being described, and it sets up a pattern. You see a pattern in these verses. Now, a pattern does not make something non-historical. A pattern here is used to describe the order of the creation, and it's actually a very patterned section. It's patterned around the number 7. There are, in the first verse, 7 Hebrew words. The second verse has 14 Hebrew words. The last part of this section is actually found in chapter 2, and it has 3 Hebrew sentences with 7 words each. This is very deliberate. This is crafted in a very deliberate way. And in fact, some of the statements here that are made in verses 3 through 5 are found 7 times in the chapter. And beyond that, you have the mention of God 35 times, which again is a multiple of 7. So this author has been very careful in how he worded this passage, because he wants to explain that this is a very organized creation. The pattern that we have set up here, there's a statement, "and God said." There's a command that follows that. There's a fulfillment to that command, "and it was so." And on day one, there's the combining of the fulfillment with God's action. Very often God will act next after the command. And then God names the creation. He speaks again. And then there's evening and morning and the number of the day. And that's the pattern that's set up in this section. Now, when we read these words, with our modern way of looking at things, something seems wrong with this. Because we'd say, well, how in the world can there be a day, an evening and morning, without a sun? And then we'd also say, how is God separating light from darkness? That's not how it works. Well, when God separates the light, it's really the text is describing in their worldview, their way of looking at things, that God is basically assigning where the light is able to work, where its jurisdiction is. The light can function in this way. Now, if we were to describe it scientifically, we'd probably talk about how God was establishing the properties of light. But here, it's just saying God is in charge of light. He made it. He's telling it where it can exist. And so that's not problematic. And nor is it problematic for there to be an evening and morning without a sun. Because even if you're a person who describes the origin of the universe in a materialistic way, everybody that I know of that talks about that says that light emerged before the sun did. And all you need here for there to be an evening and morning is this unformed earth to be rotating. That's all you need. So that's not problematic either, really, at the end of the day. The other thing that we should probably mention here is, how are we to understand this word day? It could be used to describe something more than just 24 hours. But even people who wouldn't say that this is historical, they wouldn't view it that way, or however they're going to look at it, they have to admit that when it says evening and morning, it's pretty clear that the intention of the author is to talk about a normal 24-hour day. So it's not, I don't think Moses could have been more clear with that, but beyond that, Moses also writes in Exodus chapter 20 and verse 11 that this is the basis for the Sabbath law. In the same way that God worked for 6 days and rested on the seventh, so the Israelites are supposed to do the same thing. So it does seem to be suggesting that day here is regular 24-hour day. Well, God then takes up the next situation that needs to be addressed, and he begins to form the unformed earth. And we see that beginning in the second day, verses 6 through 8. So let's look at that. It says, "And God said, let there be an expanse in the midst of the waters, and let it separate the waters from the waters. And God made the expanse and separated the waters that were under the expanse from the waters that were above the expanse, and it was so. And God called the expanse heaven, and there was evening and there was morning the second day." Now, whenever we look at the Old Testament or the New Testament for that matter, we have to understand that God reveals truth to people where they are, with their understanding of things. He revealed truth to these Israelites who did not think scientifically. So they would go out their door just like we would and see the same things we see. When we look up at the sky, we see a blue sky with clouds and a sun and a moon. Well, from where we're standing, you cannot see the distance between the clouds and the sun. And so what God is explaining in this passage is, where did the sky come from? God made the sky. It's not being detailed about the science behind that. He's just saying God created the sky. And he's talking in ways, they call them phenomenological ways. Just basically, the way that we see things, that's the way God's talking to this people. So where did the sky come from? Where did the clouds come from? Why is there water below and water above? God created the sky. That's what he's saying here. And again, if you were to compare Israel's story with the other stories in their day, the other stories would have this sea dragon that is fighting the gods, and they're cut in half, and then the god splits the sea dragon, and there's a sky in the middle and the water above water. This is not what the Bible is saying. On occasion, you'll hear a professor say that the Bible borrowed from these ancient stories. That person has not read the ancient stories, or he has not read the Bible. One of the two. The Bible is saying something dramatically different. There is no battle. There are no rival gods. There are no rival powers. God just speaks, and he assigns the places where the waters can go. He ends up creating the sky in this way. And the creation of the sky is really important for the Israelites, because that explains things like rain. And how the rain comes is very, very important for their world of farming. Now, the people all around them would have been encouraging them. They would have been tempted to sacrifice to Baal to make sure that the rain would come. That's what they were taught by their surrounding Canaanites. And they were taught, well, you better do this, otherwise your crops are all going to dry up because there's not going to be any rain. Well, this teaching from God is to show them why that's so ignorant. God's telling them, look, Baal can't help you. I created the sky. I am in charge of the rain. So he's very other gods. Now, day two does not have that refrain there that God saw that it was good. And I think probably the reason for that is that he's not done forming the water. And so he goes on to form the water in the next day. So look at verses 9 through 13. It says, "And God said, let the waters under the heavens be gathered together into one place, and let the dry land appear. And it was so. And God called the dry land earth, and the waters that were gathered together he called seas. And God saw that it was good. And God said, let the earth sprout vegetation, plants yielding seed, and fruit trees bearing fruit, in which is their seed, each according to its kind on the earth. And it was so. The earth brought forth vegetation, plants yielding seed according to their own kinds, and trees bearing fruit in which is their seed, each according to its kind. And God saw that it was good, and there was evening and there was morning, the third day." So God establishes the dry land and the seas. What he's doing is he's creating a habitable world for humans. He's doing what's necessary so that humanity can survive. And then once he's done, he pronounces it as good. And when God does that with the light, and when he does that here, what he's saying is that he approves of what he created. And he approves of it because it functions the way that he made it to function. When it's good, it does what it's supposed to do. And actually in 1 Timothy 4, Paul says that we can still call creation good. It's marred by sin, but it's still able to do what God intended it to do. So it's still good. And God goes on, he's not finished with creation on the third day, and he produced vegetation. And then that's described, the author includes two specific types of vegetation that again are important to the Israelites. On the one hand, it's on this day that God creates the plants that they were going to grow for their crops, the plants yielding seed. And they were also going to be concerned about things like fruit trees, their produce. So God isn't exhaustive here in describing plant life. He's just focusing in. He explains, I created vegetation, and that includes the two things that you guys are most concerned about. And so he zeroes in on what affects them. He also says that this vegetation is according to their kinds, their own kinds. What that meant was that Baal or any other god were not the things that were producing this life. God had arranged this cycle. He orchestrated it so that this is how plant life works. And he orchestrated it that way, not to step apart from it, not to step back from it, but that this is how plants were going to produce more plants. So up to this point, God has formed the unformed. And now he goes on to address light one more time. So he addressed the light earlier, but now we get a second look at how God shines light in the darkness. And look at verses 14 through 19. It says, "And God said, let there be lights in the expanse of the heavens to separate the day from the night, and let them be for signs and for seasons and for days and years, and let them be lights in the expanse of the heavens to give light upon the earth. And it was so. And God made the two great lights, the greater light to rule the day and the lesser light to rule the night and the stars. And God set them in the expanse of the heavens to give light on the earth, to rule over the day and over the night, and to separate the light from the darkness. And God saw that it was good. And there was evening and there was a morning, the fourth day." Now, this is actually one of the most detailed creation days. Day three is pretty important, but this day stands out. And one of the reasons for that, I think, is hinted at by the fact that there's something conspicuously missing from this section about the creation of the sun and the moon. So scan through those verses again and look for the words sun and moon. There are a few translations that have it, but most of your translations don't have it for a good reason. It's not actually in the Hebrew text. And God was very deliberate in excluding those words because those words in Hebrew were nearly identical to the words for those gods. The sun god and the sun were almost the same word. And the sun god or the moon god and the moon were almost the same word. And God is being absolutely clear. There are no other gods here. These are not gods. These are just what he calls them here. He calls them lights. That's what they are. They're just lights. They're not divine rivals. They're just creations. God made them. God assigns how they work. He says that they're created to bear light for the earth. They're the light bearers. And then he also says they're for signs and for seasons. God had planned. Israel's reading this. And God's explaining to them, look, I planned for this order so that I could set up these feasts and festivals that you're going to be worshiping me with. So from the very beginning, that was God's intention. And he also says that it was for days and years. And that was especially important for those farmers. You need to know when to plant, when to harvest. And God's saying, I set this up so that you would know these things, so that you would be able to plant when you're supposed to and harvest when you're supposed to. But again, there's no rivals here. There are no sun gods, no moon gods. There's just the one God who establishes where these lights can work, how they function. So once God sees that his creation is good, that it functions the way it's supposed to, he moves on, and now we see him filling the void. So he begins to fill the void here on this fifth day. So look at verses 20 through 23. It says, and God said, let the waters swarm with swarms of living creatures, and let birds fly above the earth across the expanse of the heavens. So God created the great sea creatures and every living creature that moves with which the waters swarm, according to their kinds, and every winged bird according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. And God blessed them, saying, be fruitful and multiply and fill the waters in the skies and let birds multiply on the earth. And there was evening and there was morning, the fifth day. Now something changes at this point. There's something new here. That's why Moses uses the word created to show that. God speaks life into existence here. And he's filling now the sea and the sky that he had previously formed. Now, as the pattern goes, God speaks, he commands that their existence, and then he goes on to create them. He mentions this action here in verse 21. Look at what he created first at verse 21. It says that God created the great sea creatures. Now, that's borderline mythological. He's got these giant sea creatures that he's describing there. But that is something that you would see in those ancient myths, right? There's this great sea dragon that the gods have to battle. And that's just what makes this so striking, is that God's not battling this. This is just another creature. It's just another creation. This is just another thing he's made. There's no Tiamat dragon that he has to fight. He created anything, any large creature that's in the sea. It is not anything that is vying for power. Moses again goes on to describe this life, flying life and swimming life. Just like the vegetation, it's reproducing according to its kind. This is how it continues its existence. And God approves of what he created. He calls it good. It functions the way that it's supposed to. But again, there's something special about this life. And we see that when Moses uses that word created. But we also see it by the fact that God blesses this creation. The pattern has been God speaks, commands, acts, and then he names the creation. Here, he speaks, he acts, and then he blesses. Before he showed his sovereign authority over it by naming it, now he's showing his sovereignty by blessing the creation. I'm going to say more about blessing next week, but suffice it to say here that I should turn off my phone. Suffice it to say here that this is not a command for the animals to obey, right? He's not saying, be fruitful and multiply. Now you have to obey this word. What's at stake here is still a continuation of God's creation. God is telling us his plan. He intends to multiply these creatures all over the planet. And he's also telling us that he is going to enable that to take place. It's not automatic like these other things that he's creating. Just like he commands and things appear, here his command has a creative work to it. He's ensuring that his plan for these creatures is going to happen. It's just not going to happen immediately. It's going to be a gradual process that eventually they fill the earth. That's his plan. That's what is going to succeed. Now, as day five concludes, we get to the final day of creation, day six, and it's the climactic day. More time is spent on day six than any other day, and that's why we're not going to cover all of day six today. So we're going to cover part of it and look at what's happening. But the reason why it's climactic is because it's the creation of humanity. That, as we come to see, is the focal point of what God is doing in this world. That his filling and forming have more to do with humanity than any other created thing. And he goes on to show that. So we're just going to look at the first part, draw some conclusions, and then look at the next part next week. So just look at verses 24 and 25. It says, "And God said, let the earth bring forth living creatures according to their kinds, livestock and creeping things and beasts of the earth according to their kinds. And it was so. And God made the beasts of the earth according to their kinds and the livestock according to their kinds and everything that creeps on the ground according to its kind. And God saw that it was good." So God again begins to fill the earth with living creatures that reproduce according to their kinds. And again, as we saw with the sea life, this is not just a naturalistic process. It's not that God set up the dominoes of animal life reproduction and just tips the one over. That's not what's being described here. This is not just an automatic process. He is saying, though, that he created things this way so that they work this way. He's not stepping back from it, but he's showing us how he multiplies these creatures according to their kinds. And you can also see these, again, some divisions happening here. And those divisions are not exhaustive divisions, but he's telling us these different kinds of animals because they're important to Israel. So we have the livestock there. This is what would have been most important to Israel. These are your domesticated animals, sheep and cattle. And once again, in the ancient world, they were tempted to go and sacrifice to a god like Baal so that their sheep and cattle would be fertile. And God's saying very clearly, don't do that. Baal has nothing to do with this. I created these animals. I created the livestock. I created the way it works. I am the one that you should worship. Then he also mentions these creepy crawly creatures, you know, the snakes and your insects and all those kinds of things. And what that does mean is there's good news. They do have a point to life other than just scaring us to death. There's some point to their existence. I don't know what it is, but I can believe that there's a point to their existence. But then Moses also mentions these wild animals, these beasts, the wild animals, that they too have a function. They have a purpose. God created them to fulfill his purposes. Now, as Israel heard about these days of creation, as they heard this, a lot of things would have stood out, but the biggest thing that would have jumped out at them is the way this reoriented their whole worldview. They had been raised in a world that was all about mythology. Things happened because the gods were making them happen, and the gods were doing that because there was this mysterious law that determined everything, how everything happened in the universe. And so what God is doing here is he's explaining to them graciously, that's not how the world works. This is how you should view your world. That's what he's explaining to them in this opening chapter. And that's important for us too, because we actually have a modern mythology. We may not realize it, and it's actually told to us in a way that says, this is what is scientific. This is what is modern. This is the way things really work. It's called Darwinian evolution. And it is what everybody accepts as fact. This is just the way things are. But it's a perspective that's based on two very important beliefs, first and foremost. You cannot believe in Darwinian evolution as a scientific idea unless you believe these two things. First of all, if you want to analyze the past and to determine how we got here scientifically, you have to absolutely believe that things are happening now the way that they have always happened without any deviation. It's called uniformitarianism. You have to believe that. You also have to believe that everything can be explained by natural processes and natural processes alone. It's called naturalism. Now, you have to believe those things to be able to study the past in a scientific way. You cannot have deviations. You cannot have anything supernatural. Otherwise, it ruins any attempt to study the past. It ruins it. Now, what that ends up producing is essentially a false god. Because in the words of Carl Sagan, a noted atheist, in his book, The Cosmos, he says, "The cosmos is all there is or has been or will be," which is probably intentionally like the way that God is referred to in Revelation as the God who is and who was and who is to come. See, what our society, our mythology of our day says is that God is ultimately unnecessary. Everything can be explained by science. But you know, when you step back and think about that, it's actually pretty ridiculous. Kent Hughes describes this encounter with Sir Isaac Newton that he had. Hughes explains this way. He says, Newton had a mechanical replica of our solar system made in miniature. At its center was a large golden ball representing the sun, and revolving around it were smaller spheres attached to the ends of rods of varying lengths. They represented Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, and the other planets. These were all geared together by cogs and belts to make them move around the sun in a perfect harmony. Now, one day, as Newton was studying the model, an unbelieving friend stopped by for a visit. Marveling at the device and watching as the scientists made the heavenly bodies move in their orbits, the man exclaimed, "My, Newton, what an exquisite thing. Who made it for you?" Without looking up, Sir Isaac Newton replied, "Nobody." "Nobody?" his friend asked. "That's right. I said nobody. All these balls and cogs and belts and gears just happened to come together. And wonder of wonders, by chance they began revolving in their set orbits with perfect timing." It's pretty ridiculous. If you understand what you understand, many of the physicists, especially the earliest physicists, said it's ridiculous to not believe in a God once they'd studied what they'd studied. Now, I know that there are issues concerning how we observe the data in our universe. We observe it in a certain way, and godly people do disagree about this subject. But one of the things that Genesis 1 is very clear about is it dismantles any belief in naturalism or uniformitarianism. God is sovereign over the creation. He is not bound by the inflexible natural laws that Kushner talked about at the beginning. He is natural law. Natural law is merely the observation of what God has done and what God is doing. That's what natural law is. And God does not have to act in the same way that he usually does. He hasn't, in fact, and most notably is the way that he acted differently when he became man, lived a perfect life, died, and rose again. That's not what we normally observe. It's very clear in the Bible that the Father created the world through the Son. If you look at Genesis 1, it basically points back to this text in Genesis. So John 1, I don't know if I said Genesis or John there, John 1, verse 1 says, "In the beginning," he is being deliberate in pointing us back to Genesis chapter 1. "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things were made through him, and without him was not anything made that was made." And then look down to verse 14. "And the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we have seen his glory, glory as of the only Son from the Father, full of grace and truth." All things were created through the one who took on flesh and died for us. He is the creator. And that doesn't happen every day. God became man, lived a perfectly human life, died for sinners, and then was raised from the dead. You don't normally observe that happening. So the truth is, there really is no difference between what we typically refer to as supernatural and what we refer to as natural. Everything is supernatural. The only reason why we talk about things as supernatural is because they're just deviations from what God normally does. God is not bound in any way by some intransigent natural law. The Psalm 115:3 says, "Our God is in the heavens. He does all that he pleases." Please God to create this world by speaking it into existence. That's what Psalm 33:6 says. It's talking about Genesis now. God did just that. It says, "By the word of the Lord, the heavens were made, and by the breath of his mouth, all their host." So this amazing God can do whatever he chooses to do. He's not bound by the limitations of creation. He's not limited by space. He is everywhere. He's present everywhere. He's not limited by time. He's eternal. He's not limited by power. He's all powerful. And this God is wise. He is wise enough to create every square inch of this universe. From atoms to cells, from stars to mountains, he created it all. And that means something to us. That means that there is no problem that we're facing that he cannot handle. And at the same time, it also says that there's no situation that we face that doesn't have a reason for why we're facing it. That this sovereign God is our creator, and there are reasons for why we go through what we do. And it also empowers our prayers. This belief that God is our sovereign creator, it gives us the hope that we can actually talk to the one who made everything and who sustains everything. He can give us hope that we will have what we need to face whatever it is that he has us face. So creation is what founds our understanding of prayer and how we live our lives. At the same time, this truth that God spoke the world into existence is what establishes the power of the gospel. Look over to 2 Corinthians here. 2 Corinthians chapter 4. We'll look at verses 3 through 6. And just listen to how this develops. It says, "And even if our gospel is veiled, it is veiled to those who are perishing. In their case, the God of this world has blinded the minds of the unbelievers to keep them from seeing the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ, who is the image of God. For what we proclaim is not ourselves, but Jesus Christ as Lord, with ourselves as your servants for Jesus' sake." Now listen to this, verse 6. "For God who said, 'Let light shine out of darkness,' has shone in our hearts to give the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ." The God who spoke light into existence has shone light into our hearts. Paul was very adamant. The power in our evangelism is not in our persuasiveness. And it's not at all in our ability to seize the moment. The power of evangelism is in the gospel. Every time Paul talks about this, Romans 1:16, "I'm not ashamed of the power of God," or of the gospel, because it's the power of God. This is the power. When God speaks to us through the gospel, something miraculous happens. When God speaks to us through the gospel, the same God who supernaturally spoke and cause light to shine is the God who speaks through the gospel and causes light to shine into our dark hearts. Conversion is nothing less than the miraculous taking place, where God is creating anew. That's exactly what Paul goes on to say in 2 Corinthians chapter 5. In verse 17, he says, "Therefore, if anyone is in Christ, he is a new creation." So what happens at conversion through the gospel, where God speaks life into us, it's miraculous. So then the question is, have you experienced that supernatural work? Have you heard God speaking to you through the gospel? The question you might ask is, well, how do I know that? Well, are you grieving over your sin? And are you seeing that you need Jesus? You need the salvation that he provided. You recognize that you cannot be right with God apart from Jesus. If you are hearing that and seeing that God is speaking to you through the gospel, you can trust that he will save all who come to him. So trust in the salvation that he provided through his son, through his death, and through his resurrection. It is a supernatural recreation that he produces through that act. So put your trust in him. He can do it. Let's pray. Father, we thank you that you are a God who created us and that you revealed that truth to us. You are a God who is not bound by anything in this world. There's nothing that limits your power. There's nothing that limits your ability. We can come up with lots of reasons, lots of problems to what we see here in this chapter. But the reality is that you are not in the box that we're trying to put you in. You are outside of that box. You are a God who is not bound by this creation. You made it. You're not bound by the universe or the rules of the universe. You made them. There's nothing that is outside of your ability to do if you want to do it. And Father, we thank you for that truth, to know that we can trust you to save us, because of that reality that you're the creator, you're also the God who brings about new creation in our hearts through Christ. So, Father, I ask that you would do that in lives, even today, that you would, we would see that new life. And at the same time, God, that you would empower us to live our lives with true faith, that you're not some wimpy God who's just doing the best that he can. You are an all-powerful God who made the heavens and the earth, and there's nothing outside of your ability to deal with. And at the same time, you're the God who is sovereign over it even now. And that even though difficult things happen to us, God, you have a reason for that. I pray that we would trust you. We'd know your love, know your wisdom, and trust you as the all-powerful God who is behind all that we face. Give us that faith through your word, by your spirit, and because of your son. Amen.